I'm Andrea Loyan, Vermont Edition producer, and I just wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. You don't have to look very hard these days to find a headline about the drug crisis. News stories and political statements are often full of data points and buzzy phrases like overdose prevention strategies, community-based restorative justice, the hub-and-spoke treatment system. But what does addiction feel like in the body? What do cravings do to your mind? And what kind of physical pain does withdrawal create? These are the questions that my colleague Erica Heilman asked Vermonters experiencing active drug addiction. She compiled some of their stories in a recent episode of her award-winning podcast, Rumble Strip. Today, we're going to listen to that episode together. I should tell you first, though, that what we're about to hear includes adult themes, including graphic descriptions of drug use, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. Please take good care while listening. Later in the show, we'll hear from a local recovery coach from Barrie. She'll share her own story and answer your questions about how to support yourself or loved ones with addiction. If you have thoughts about this episode while you're listening, you can also email them to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We'll open up the phone lines towards the end of the show. But first, let's listen together to Rumble Strip.
You ever see somebody not enough, like drooling on themselves, not enough? You know how much money they spend and how much effort goes into being in that condition? It's black. There's no dreaming, there's no thinking, there's no nothing. It is quiet, it's remarkably peaceful. I love it, I don't care what anybody says.
That's Mark. He got addicted to opiates after being prescribed Vicodin following back surgery. There are all kinds of reasons why addiction happens. No one does it on purpose, and addiction is not discriminating. It's like some terrible lottery. It happens to people with money and without money, people just starting out in life and people with kids and thriving businesses, people from cities and people from small towns. But this isn't a story about how addiction starts or even how it ends. Last year, I made a story about my private investigator friend, Susan Randall, after her office was robbed in the middle of the day in downtown Burlington by a woman with a very serious addiction problem. She walked into Susan's office while people were working there and loaded a bag full of electronics and left. After I made that story, I kept thinking about the woman. I know she was stealing in order to trade or sell the electronics for drugs, but where was she actually coming from that day? Where was she going? The world of active addiction is a kind of world underneath the world, with its own rules, its own schedules, but to most people, it's invisible. All four of the people in this story are in recovery, but they each spent years in that world of active addiction, and they agreed to talk about it, to describe it to me, what it feels like day to day, and its endless demands. Here's Eric Breyer.
So you score the drugs and you buy it and you're excited and you're happy because you know you're about to get that reward in your mind. And you load up your syringe and find a vein, pull back to register, which is the blood gushing into the syringe, and then you plunge it down and immediately you start to get just a warm, comforting sensation that goes into your chest and kind of around your neck and up over the top of your head. And it's like a relaxing, almost like comforting, warm embrace. And it's really a magnificent feeling. I mean, people choose this over like natural highs that you would get. Like say you accomplish something you set out to do and that feeling of just accomplishment or anything like that just doesn't measure up. You know, I can't think of a natural feeling that even compares. It's the most powerful feeling of comfort, and you know, you could be on the side of a building next to a dumpster that someone had just come through and urinated in, And your surroundings don't matter. It's all what you're getting internally. It's like the ultimate answer. And that would be a warning to anybody who was thinking of, you know, taking opiates for the first time. You will enjoy it. It will be exactly the way I described. And if you continue, it will bring you to the dumpster, the urination, the darkest side street that you can imagine, where, you know, people are walking by wondering if you're dead or alive.
Again, here's Mark.
Can you go to a state park on Memorial Day and go have a good time just being at the state park? I can't. I will f***ing hate it. It's boring, you don't want to be there. Do a couple bags on the way. I don't know, throw a few writs down or whatnot, sure. It's easy enough. Stops inhibition, stops a lot of anxiety as well. So, people can say drugs are f***ed up all day, but every addict likes drugs. I don't give a f*** who they are. They f***ing love them. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. I don't like sharks, so I stay the f*** out of the ocean. I love drugs. If I didn't want to be doing them, I wouldn't do them. And life is boring. So ask any addict. Like, I like my job, but I know exactly what I can go do right now to have more fun at my job. I don't like the damage that comes with it. But that's the big difference.
This is Avery Stats.
I didn't shower. I didn't brush my teeth. I didn't brush my hair. Like, you don't want to do anything else, because when you get in the shower, you can't be smoking crack. Like, it's that addictive that you can't even leave it for a second. The brain is telling you you need it to survive. So it's like trying to get food and water, and you will do anything to get food and water. And that's what people getting drugs feel like. So I wouldn't take care of myself at all. And I had hair down to my butt that ended up getting all matted together in one tight ball on the back of my head because I wouldn't brush it and I wouldn't shower. So I went from this intelligent person in high school that was going to college to this drug addicted, matted hair, 100-pound, like, zombie type person. Like, it was really a really rough big change. It only took 1 month from starting crack to get me to that point. Like, it went downhill very, very fast.
You go from being dope sick to not dope sick. That right there is the high. You're just not sick.
But what's the people talk about being dope sick like it's hell. What is so bad about it?
Ever have a panic attack? It's like a panic attack all day long. Can't rest, can't sleep, can't stop moving, don't want to sit down, can't stop sweating. Take a cold bath to take care of the hot and sweat your brains out after you take a cold shower. It's horrible. The restless legs, where your head goes, the negativity, it's just not good. Eyes get sunken in, color, skin turns yellow. There's a twitchiness in the eyes. Addicts don't want to talk about it, so they'll tell you it's like the flu. It's 10 times worse than the flu. Throw a little pneumonia on top of that. So yeah, you're f***ing your brains out. Me, I wasn't into puking or anything.
So what do?
You deal. Or you start stealing.
Again, here's Eric.
The idea of impending sickness, like, even if I had enough drugs to get me through an entire month and not worry about it, it would still give me the worst anxiety, knowing that eventually it's going to run out and I'm going to be sick.
So you get sick. Is it really? I mean, like, how scary can it be to get sick?
Yeah, it causes insane amount of anxiety. Like, the worst pain and aches and throwing up, fever, skin crawling. Withdrawal is powerful. And the key thing to remember, and that every addict knows, is that you don't have to feel that way, because there's something right there within your reach that can take that all away in 1 second. And the majority of addicts, myself included, say, no way.
It's like being a hungry animal.
This is Raina Lowell.
Who I am as a person, it does not get come into play at all. For instance, if right now I found someone's wallet, I would not open the wallet and take the money out of the wallet. I would open it to see if there was an ID and then reach out to that person, or if it's somebody I know, hey, you left your wallet. But when I was in the throes of addiction, you better trust and believe, I would have like scurried away and then looked to see if there was money in there, and I would have taken them. It's not that I didn't have that voice saying this is wrong. It's just that everything else is so much louder. And I just learned how to push that voice aside because I am still me and I do still have values, but I can't look at them because I'm being driven by something that is way more powerful than, believe it or not, even the love for my own children. Right? Like, what can be more powerful than the love that a mother has for her child? But at this point, like, my hands are off the steering wheel. I mean, by the time things got really bad, we were living in our home in Montpelier in the middle of winter in Vermont with no heat, you know? And I had, for a while, I had been sneaking over to my neighbor's house to steal firewood because they had some stacked firewood outside. And then when that was no longer an option, I started breaking our kitchen chairs and burning those. We basically, the three of us, just slept in the living room, you know, kind of huddled around the wood stove. I mean, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare.
When you're in addiction that deeply, you don't see anything else. You'll be driving through town, you only see drug streets, drug houses. You're driving around to get to one drug house to the next, or to go get money, or to go get drugs. Like, you don't see anyone else, you don't connect to people that aren't drug addicts. You're not even really connecting with other drug addicts, but in parallel to that, when you're sober, and you're sober for a while, you don't even see those drug houses anymore or anything like that. It's almost a different dimension when you're driving around as an addict. You're like underneath the world. It feels like you're underneath everything.
Today, we are listening to a recent episode of the podcast Rumble Strip. My colleague Erica Heilman spoke to folks in our region who are actively in the throes of addiction. And if you're just joining us, a reminder that what we're listening to today includes some pretty adult themes, including graphic descriptions of drug use. It may not be suitable for all listeners, and please take care of yourself while listening. In about 15 minutes, we'll be joined by a drug counselor in Barrie who can answer your questions and help us process what we heard. And with that, let's dive back into Rumble Strip.
Can you give me an example of, like, to walk me through a day from the very start of it?
Okay, so if you're fortunate and you kind of plan ahead, the first thing you do when you get up is use, because you've fallen asleep, your body has metabolized the drugs, you are sick when you wake up, and you need that right away. So you get up, you'll get right, you'll have your fix, and once I've gotten well, you know, I start reaching out to people in my contact list on my phone of who I can meet up with and what we can then hatch for a scheme to feed our habits throughout the day. Or I have a plan to get money, whether that's go to the department store and steal, or I have a connection with somebody who will front us the drugs to go, you know, peddle a bundle of dope for myself. I could go through that in two shots and figure, if I'm doing three shots from breakfast to lunch, three shots from, you know, that's, I have to come up with $1,500 a day. Or I could middle these drug deals to my friends in addiction and not have to come out of pocket, but run the risk of, you know, incarceration and the things that come with dealing drugs.
Not everybody can middle the drugs. So somebody's coming up with $1,500 a day. How does that work?
Well, there's all sorts of scams and schemes. You know, some people panhandle in the street. You see people on the on-ramps or the exit ramps of the highways saying that they're homeless, and they probably are homeless. What they don't tell you is I'm horribly addicted to drugs and I don't want to go steal in some department store to support my habits, so I'm trying to at least remain honorable.
But you can't make $1,000 panhandling in a day.
No. So theft, petty theft, like selling stolen merchandise, female addicts will sell their bodies or trade their bodies. I suppose male addicts probably do that too.
So just even a bag of dope would be about $1, maybe $1.50 coming out of, I don't know, Springfield, Holyoke, any of those. Up here, it's like $40. That is a tremendous amount of money. My brother pulled in probably $2.5 million a month. So it allows for a lot of leeway and an incredible amount of power. And that's what he thrived on, was the power that came with it. People do everything in their world for you.
So it's morning and you're smart enough that you have saved something from yesterday. Then what?
Do what you saved from yesterday and start looking.
Where do you go? Like, what the hell? I mean, you live in one town. Like, there are a lot of days. There are many, many days to come. Days and days and days.
Go pedal. Nickel and dime it. Bottles, anything that can become a quick buck. Steal. Rob cheap, break into cars. It's unbelievable how much people will come up with. And you don't have to sell the stuff to a pawn shop. You just bring it over to the dealer. If he likes it, he gives you a bag of dope. Which in your mind's $40. In his mind, it's $1. And it don't matter because, you know, he made his sales. All you gotta do is sell like 10% to cover your cost. The rest of it's all profit. Dumb went up to the John Deere place in the middle of Route 4 in the middle of the day. Stole a massive tractor, like the one with the Kubota across the street. 120 horsepower, huge tractor. Drove it right down Route 4 in the center of Rutland, right down Route 7, right down North Street, right into my brother's driveway. And he took it. People would show up all kinds of. He had a room, literally three times the size of this, and I think there were 66 TVs in it. And he had 14 kayaks, like 8 snowmobiles, but it's millions of dollars worth of just shit. Cleaning supplies, vacuums, vacuum bags, Windex like you wouldn't believe.
Why Windex?
Because it's easy to steal from your employer. Toilet paper, paper towels, food. Yeah, it's anything. Anything can be turned into money.
A trap house is really just a drug hub. And most trap houses, you can tell from the outside pretty much. It's always some rundown apartment with a crappy door. There's usually a mattress on the floor, a couple mattresses on the floor that are stained, and on the bed, someone is sitting with ashtrays and all their paraphernalia, needles, pipes, tin foils. The carpet is always filthy with dirt and stains and garbage. There's always people standing around smoking cigarettes. There'll be a dealer sitting there or in the back room. Maybe a TV.
There may be an animal. Somebody may have a dog. Dimly lit towels over all the windows.
You're there to get something. When you see them, what do you think?
Depending on their movement or lack of movement is whether or not the drugs that are there at that particular time are any good. You know?
What does that mean? What do you mean?
So if I see somebody, you know, acting crazy and I happen to be there to buy some crack, you know, I can pretty much guaranteed by the way that they're moving or behaving that is strong product. Or if a person who is unconscious laying on the floor in a nod, I'll know that the dope is good and that I've come to the right place, which rather than having or being alarmed that somebody is not moving, laying on the floor, I'm excited.
Is there any kind of familial... What's the communication like?
It's real simple. It's like, are you holding? Are you good? No? All right, well, who is? Because clearly there's something here. It's not like, hey, how have things been? You know how they've been. It's all terrible. Whether or not things seem to be going well for any person on a given day, once the supply runs out, it's back to your life is terrible, miserable, 24/7.
So there's no, hey, John, how's it going?
No, I think it's pretty obvious to everyone who's stuck in the grip of addiction that it's not going well for anybody.
You don't know you're overdosing. Like, you do the drugs, and next thing you know, you're on the floor. You wake up because somebody Narcan'd you. So what people don't realize, they think someone's Narcan'd, and they just wake up. And Narcan is naloxone, which pushes all the opioids out of your brain receptors, which triggers your body to push all the drugs out of your system any way it can. So you wake up on the floor, and all of a sudden, you feel this extreme chest pain, burning. It's like burning your entire body, but especially in your chest. It's not even hot. It's like this stinging, burning feeling. You're in extreme pain, like your body's locking up, convulsing. All of a sudden, you start projectile vomiting. Some people themselves. Some people hallucinate. It's one of the worst things I've ever gone through, and that says a lot. You're literally crawling your way back from death.
What I know is what's happening these days is f***ing disturbing. I'm just throwing xylazine and the f***ing fentanyl and everything. It's making people psychotic. For years, people would smoke some pot, smoke some crack, sit on the couch, melt into the couch, watch TV, play a video game, or go along the coke route, get a bump in energy. Nowadays, they're not. Like, a couple of hits of crack is not going to get you up with a few good bell ringers walking around doing the gardening. You know, you're making a mess, but you're doing gardening. It's psychosis. I don't know any other word for it. Nowadays, people are eating their skin off their bodies. Huge gashes showing up in skin, like something you'd see in, like, third world, I don't know, fucking Malaysia back with the pirates. I ain't go down here to an overdose and have no clue what you're dealing with. No clue at all. So there's no reprieve for it. They're actively making things to fight any overdose meds. There's no way to deal with it. There's no way to console it. There's no way to empathize. There's nothing you can do other than wait for the cops to come.
You know, I've always said that the withdrawal pieces, that's the easiest part. It's what's on the other side of that. I'm kind of stripped of all my normal coping skills and abilities, and everything is just so visceral, but not in a good way. It's not like you also get the flip side, right? Where like everything's also, you know, super funny or, you know, exciting or no, it's all just like very raw.
Raw, and it sounds like it's both raw, but also promises to be boring.
I know.
You know?
Like, would you want to eat a meal that was described as raw and boring? No. I certainly don't want to live a life that way, you know? I do think it's gradual and all that, but for some reason, hitting that 1 year mark for me, I was like, I think I might be on a new path here, you know? Like, this might be working.
You know, you're trying to see the future through eyes that are just reopening to the idea of having a future, because everybody who has been in the grip of addiction knows that there is no future in drug addiction. There is no end of the road that is happy. There's no happy ending in it at all. So the normal world, for a person to come back to that after the depths that their addiction has brought them is completely overwhelming. You're not sure how to interact. Like, you get very savvy on the street life, like what is expected, how to act. You know, there are codes that you adhere to, but coming over onto this end, and you become a normal person, a 9-to-5 recovered person, and there's no adrenaline, there's no, you know, you have to fall back into a routine and rebuild. Like, how do I, you know, change my address at the post office to receive mail at my new residence? Like all those stupid things that you don't care about the mail when you're an opiate addict. Like who, there are no bills or collection agencies. You're afraid that you're not going to be able to deal with all of the overwhelming things of everyday life without drugs. The fear is a constant, regardless of if you're an addict or not. Maybe that's the key to bridging the gap between normal people who have never experienced addiction. It's pretty relatable. Like, you can relate to being afraid of something. Like, there are commonalities that cross over between addicts and non-addicts.
Fear, the common ingredient for us all.
Maybe.
I remember a day, it was a sunny afternoon in Brattleboro, and I was sitting on a bench near the co-op with my sponsor, my AA sponsor. And I really respected this woman that I was working with. She was so smart. And we were just sitting on a bench, just talking, nothing else. I was sober. I'd been sober for a little while. And something happened. It was almost like a clouds parting moment where I all of a sudden could see everything around me as if almost like it was the first time. And it was like this, I was like, shit, I can't believe this has been here the whole time. Just this like beauty, this like feeling of comfort, and I looked over at her, and she had this kind of this smile on her face and this knowing look on her face, like she saw it happen, you know. And I just like tears started just like streaming down my face. It was such a moment. But I think maybe it was just a level of clarity that I had not seen in so long, and a connection. Because, I mean, that's it, right? A lack of connection in active addiction. There is no connection to this life that we're living on this beautiful planet, you know? Yeah.
What if darkness was light, under cover of bright? We'd stalk up, pray they can't see in the day, it's too white.
We are joined now for the rest of this hour by Katie Jones. She's a recovery coach with Turning Point Center of Central Vermont, and she lives in Barrie. She's here with us now to help us talk through what we just heard. Katie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, it's so great to be here.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. And listeners, we're glad to have you as well. Do you have a loved one who is experiencing addiction, or perhaps you were and are now in recovery? Do you have questions about how to offer someone support? You can join the conversation by calling 800-639-2211 or emailing vermontaddition@vermontpublic.org. Well, Katie, before we get into your story and your work, I'm wondering if you might be able to just share some of your thoughts hearing that episode of Rumble Strip that we all just listened to together.
It's a true depiction of what it's like to be in the middle of addiction. I think that folks can think that they know what it's like, and that maybe it's some type of moral failing. But it's just not. It can affect anyone.
One line
really has stuck with me since the very first time I heard that episode. One person that Erica spoke to says that addiction is like being a hungry animal. She says, mm-hmm. who I am as a person doesn't come into play at all. I'm wondering, as someone who's in recovery yourself, if what that line brings up for you.
Yeah, it's almost like one long night. The sun never comes up. It's just always dark. And, you know, I had an amazing childhood. I have an amazing family. My parents instilled in me, you know, values that everyone should have. And I became someone that I don't even recognize anymore when I was using drugs. And yeah, it ate away at me. And I've had to kind of just find out who I am now, because I didn't know. I didn't feel like a person.
And now you are a recovery coach. How did that remarkable shift happen? When did you find this career?
So while I was in the throes of my addiction, I committed a string of petty crimes, mostly retail theft, things of that nature to support my addiction. And I had an amazing lawyer who said, I think that the treatment court is something that would benefit you. And I was accepted into treatment court, and it was a really long process, but it saved my life. And during that time, I started coming to the turning point. And I just found a lot of support and people who believed in me there. And Bob Purvis, who's our director, was just there for me. He didn't judge me. And it really just, my experience there in the beginning of my recovery, I always knew that I wanted to kind of give back and to give people some hope, because I didn't have any. And I had people there who believed in me until I could believe in myself again. And doing this work is just so meaningful for me. It's just like those glimmers, right, that kind of reinforce that there can be a life after addiction.
Well, Katie, when we opened up our phone lines, the lines lit up. Clearly, this episode of Rumble Strip we listened to and this conversation that we're having with you has really touched a chord. So let's go to some of those calls now. We have Jacqueline in Roxbury up first. Jacqueline, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was just calling in to talk about my own experience in active addiction, and I felt due to, you know, the way I behaved or my looks or whatever, I got away with a lot, and that I wasn't ever in danger of getting arrested or getting caught in any way. And I think that was a huge deterrent for me. And I feel that if, you know, for a lot of my friends and people in the really liberal communities in Vermont, they talk about how addiction really needs to be able to go into a support mechanism. But the idea of also perhaps going to jail was also a major deterrent for me. So I always wonder about what the best way for those in active addiction, because the reality is we're not going to get out of active addiction unless we want to and we're ready to, and or are forced to sober up through some sort of process, which would have, you know, really scared me into probably earlier sobriety. But it's just about how to handle the it's nuanced, you know, but I mean, there is something to be said for having a deterrent there of jail time.
Mm. Yeah, Jacqueline, thank you so much for calling in and sharing those thoughts. And Katie Jones, as a recovery coach, I wonder if that's a conversation that you have often with the folks that you work with about whether or not deterrence, like the possibility of going to jail, can have an effect on changing people's behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, I'll talk about treatment court here, because it's giving that like wraparound support, but while also, you know, if you don't get into recovery, most folks are facing a lot of jail time. And, you know, probably at first, like before the first time I got arrested for something petty, it deterred me, but after a while it just becomes like a way of life. And and you know, they say, and it's kind of cliche, but they say that addiction will end in jails, institutions, or death. And it's just the reality.
Let's bring in another voice here. We have Ed calling in from Burlington. Ed, is this Ed Baker, longtime addiction and recovery coach? I believe you worked on this episode with Erica.
Yes, one and the same.
Ah, well, thank you so much for calling in. What did you want to share today?
Well, I mean, I have a lot to share, but first, what I want to share really is that I'm deeply moved to tears, actually. You know, at the openness and compassion and frank discussion of people with addiction. And, you know, there are decades in America in my lifetime, and I'm sure in your lifetime too, where people with addiction are just scorned and beaten and, you know, vilified and stigmatized and punished. And finally, in America today, we're beginning to actually understand that these are people with something to say. People with hearts, people with souls, people with families, people with futures, people who need compassion, people who need love and need help, and people who are really our moral responsibility. We cannot turn our backs on us. And I'm not going to call them. We cannot turn our backs on us. Mm. When I say, you know, there but for the grace of God, I mean it. I'm all in. I am them. I am one of them. I lived on the streets. I've injected drugs in public places. I've boosted. I've done things that I'm not going to mention on the radio, you know, and I'm alive today. And I've had 40 years of a very productive, very rich, fulfilling, meaningful life with family, with love, with income, with hobbies, you know, with a spiritual awareness. And every one of them out there, every one of us out there suffering from active addiction today, people with chaotic drug use that we see on our streets, they can live and they can thrive.
I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in here because there's something you said that I really like our guest's thoughts on, and that's this idea of this us versus them mentality. And maybe somebody who hasn't experienced addiction before, isn't in active addiction, really can't put themselves in a place where they, you know, could say this could happen to me or this could have been me. And Katie, I just want to hear if that's like a conversation you're having with your clients, a turning point, if there's what that struggle is like between feeling like you are separate from folks around you who haven't experienced addiction.
Yeah, I think it's important that we just try to kind of beat down the stigma as much as we can, because again, I come from a wonderful family. I had great parents and goals for my future. I had so much opportunity, and I became an addict. That's not what I dreamed for myself as a child, but it was the reality. And you know, like Ed said, these are people with souls and hearts and dreams for the future, as much as it's not something they're thinking about right now. as people who struggle with substances, instant gratification is, it's a real thing. And it's hard to sort of look beyond the immediate future. And it's just treating people with compassion.
Yeah.
Is what it comes down to.
Let's go next to Greg, who's calling in from Eden. Greg, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks very much for this this conversation, and once again for the open address of this this disease and how it rips the soul out of our communities in some places. My point, though, is that I want to emphasize the importance of connection. That that in my recovery, it's been so important to stay connected to people. And we say in the program that the opposite of addiction is connection. And there are so many different communities that we can reach out to and say, I need to be connected to this community. First step, though, is to step over that shame of addiction and to say, and I often remind myself that it is a sign of strength to ask for help, and I ask, and I recommend, I urge, I beg anyone that is in the throes of this disease, or even having a hard day in your recovery, to reach out to someone else who has suffered from this, or who is a connection in a recovery community. Reach out. We are absolutely not alone in this, and that those connections are the point that I want to make today.
Oh, Greg, well, thank you for helping us make those connections right here during this conversation, too. And Katie, what Greg's saying brings up a conversation we had on Vermont Edition a few weeks ago with folks from Writers for Recovery. They run workshops for folks all across the state, writing workshops for people in recovery. And one of the participants talked about having to create a new community for herself when she became sober and had to could cut a lot of connections and ties from the earlier part of her life when she was in addiction. I wonder if you could speak to that a bit. Is that an experience that you had, having to make new connections as a person in recovery?
Absolutely. The people that I was hanging around were not good people when I was using. They were dangerous and you know, allowed me to continue in my addiction. And for me, reconnecting with my family in my early recovery was really huge. It fueled me and motivated me to continue on this path of recovery. And then the connections that I've made since I've worked in the recovery community are, I just cherish them. All of the people that I work with are people in recovery themselves, and they are some of the best people I've ever met in my life.
We just got an email from a listener who asked to stay anonymous, and they write, as a family member of someone who is struggling with alcoholism and personality disorder, I am struggling to support and connect with this person while watching their life and marriage fall apart. I understand that this person is experiencing reality very differently. I want to help them, but I feel powerless. There are children involved, which is utterly heartbreaking. How can we connect with an addict? How can we help protect the person's life, family, health, future, while waiting for them to, quote, hit rock bottom? Oh, Katie, do you have any advice for this person seeking to support a family member?
I think that, you know, just continuing an open conversation, really, like, actively listening to kind of let this person know that they're not alone, because addiction is so isolating, and it is, you just feel so ashamed of yourself. And to just to remind them that recovery is possible, you know, encouraging treatment, encouraging connecting with with a recovery center, like the turning point. And also at the same time, holding those boundaries for yourself so as not to get sucked in. I heard a quote once that said that addiction is awful and it's hard and it's a nightmare, but loving an addict is worse.
Katie, where do you find your strongest community these days? What brings you joy?
Oh, I love spending time with my family. I missed so much when I was using, and it does my heart good to kind of rebuild those relationships. And the friends I've made where I work are invaluable to me. I love to be outside. And just kind of, I'm still sort of rediscovering who I am.
Yeah. And you mentioned where you work, which is Turning Point, Center of Central Vermont. As we wrap up here, could you tell us a little bit more about Turning Point and how people might be able to access those services in different parts of the state?
So there are Turning Points all over Vermont, actually. And I work at the one here in Barrie. We offer groups and meetings. The schedule for that can be found online and also on Facebook. We do peer recovery coaching, which is one-on-one coaching. And I really enjoy it because I always felt like I connected most with folks, whether they were, you know, clinicians or at the Turning Point, who had that lived experience and could relate to what I was going through. And so it's just been wonderful.
Katie, this time with you has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your openness and for talking with me. To all the folks who called in today, Katie Jones is a recovery coach with Turning Point in Barrie. Katie, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Rumble Strip, which produced the podcast episode you heard earlier today, is reported and produced by Erica Heilman. Special thanks to the voices you heard in that episode, Avery Statz, Mark, Raina Lowell, and Eric Briere. Additional thanks to Julie Bond, Ed Baker, Good Samaritan Haven, and Tobin Anderson. Music that you heard was by the band Sylvan Esso. And if you are struggling with addiction, you can call the Vermont Addiction Hotline at 866-210-1303. Today's show was directed by Mary Angish. Our managing producer is John Ahrens. Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro are our producers. Kelly Delorier was our call screener today, and our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.